Welcome back to the
Bye.
Dirt.
Welcome
back to the Dirty Inning, the Phillies podcast where we talk about the saddest, dumbest, funniest, or most obscure innings in Philadelphia Phillies history. Once again, we're going to have a conversation that no one will enjoy between myself, Justin Clue of Fangraphs and Baseball Prospectus, and a snickering weasel named Dr. Trevor Strunk.
That's Hello. Me.
Oh, what a time we're going to have today,
I
folks.
Am this weasel.
Now, you may think that this episode is going to be based around the concept of cheating or tomfoolery or a little bending of the rules, greasing of the palms.
No, we don't like that here.
That'd be a little too newsworthy for this podcast. We'll
the
save
only,
that
the
one.
The only kind of cheating we like here is the cheating that is friendship, and friendship getting you into the Hall of Fame.
Exactly. And with Hall of Fame season fresh upon us once more, and all of the wonderful conversations that are a part of that season, we have so much material to work through involving all, I believe, six of the players on the ballot this year that have played for the Philadelphia Phillies.
Nice.
And in addition to that, our favorite topic of cronyism will certainly enter the fray.
We could finally have a Long Pockets centric episode.
Exactly.
As we've always planned.
And the concept of cheating in baseball, which the Astros have gleefully introduced to the baseball lexicon this year. We will be, not introduced, it has always existed, but let it allowed to resurface as a narrative.
Justin spends 5 minutes telling me about a 1900s cheating scandal.
Don't ruin it.
Shut up. It's called teasing, Justin. It's called teasing it.
We're saving that story for a later episode of The Dirty Inning.
So now you have to subscribe.
When it's not a relevant topic anymore and you're sick of hearing about it or forgotten all about it. Then we'll bring it right on back.
Cheating? What are they talking about? Who cheated?
Which is why tonight we are finally doing our World Series episode of The Dirty Inning, or at least the episode indirectly inspired.
You guys remember that?
Indirectly inspired by the 2019 World Series. I believe last episode we did a Brian Price themed episode because that was the, several, I guess, months ago Brian Price was hired by
the
Phillies.
He's the pitching coach now.
To be the pitching coach,
that.
Yeah, that seems like old news, partially because the Phillies have really just remained on the back burner as far as news goes in baseball this year. The Astros pretty much dominated the conversation thus far. Thankfully, we have all the screaming and crying and gnashing of teeth and open palm slapping that occurs during the Hall of Fame induction conversations and debates that occur this time of year. So that's going to be the pleasantries that replace the pleasantness that is talking about the Astros cheating baseball and shaking the sport to its very foundation. So we're just going to go back and talk about our episode we never did that was indirectly inspired by the World Series this year. So I don't know if you remember the World Series this year, Trev, but
the Astros lost that World Series, right?
They did. They did lose against all odds. Odds that they had good players, odds that they had good coaching,
odds that they had, in fact, created themselves.
they had created a complex system of whistling, trash can banging, the assembling and disassembling of a television monitor hanging on the wall. What else was going on? Do we have a story about vibrating bandages?
Yeah, that's the new one. They had bandages, and if it would vibrate once if you were getting a fastball.
I love it. Here's the thing. Aren't you, as a professional baseball player,
you're talking about me specifically, right?
Right. You, as a professional baseball player. Trevor Strunk.
Professional journeyman, famously toiling in the minor leagues.
Yeah. Like rookie, like Gulf Coast League journeyman. utility infielder and outfielder.
I'm once again the single A MVP,
the garbage time long reliever for the Gulf Coast Phillies B team. You don't make it into the televised
Rolaids relief man of the year for the Gulf Coast.
Yeah. So your experience, shouldn't a baseball player, just with the skills he comes equipped with, shouldn't he just know how to pick up a fastball or be good at judging the situation and know when a fastball is coming?
Look, you would think so. I feel like, and I know this is sort of a very Twitter-ish take, and I don't mean it to sound that way. But I think that a bunch of like big time, like Wall Street people, like basically like finance people, just got a hold of the Astros and they were like, listen, you guys don't know how to cheat well enough. Like, and you know, the baseball players would be like, no, we could tell when a fastball's coming. They're like, well, not perfectly. That's why you need us.
And you know what? That's kind of what we talked about on Hidden Season. And my summation of this whole situation is that, like, yeah, it's kind of ruining any remaining nostalgia or majesty baseball may have. It's been ruined because now we just have the latest industry in which it's been revealed that a coven of white collar douche bros has taken over and found a way to hack the system. And yeah, when I say, should a baseball player, shouldn't they just know how to figure out when a fastball is coming without a bandage vibrating on their pinky finger? The answer is like, yeah, you know, instinctively, probably a lot of them do. But the whole idea is to get every advantage.
Yeah,
is
to make it foolproof. Right.
You know, value in the margins, as some people like to say.
It's the flip side of friend of both of us, I believe. Friend is probably strong, but acquaintance and colleague of both of us, Sam Miller. I don't want to make Sam feel like he has to acknowledge me as his friend. That's
way to put him in his place there. Really, distance yourself. You'll reel him in a little close. My friend. Well, casual acquaintance.
That's, I wish just... I could call him my friend, but the only person I'd curse with that is you. Mm-hmm. Sam and Ben Lindbergh's book, The Only Rule Is It Has to Work. Which is a cool book about their running a minor league team, an independent league team. And, that was kind of cool. 'Cause they basically took all the stuff that they did in their podcast. Why am I forgetting the name of that podcast? Short Relief. Excuse me. I've listened to a million episodes. The Baseball Perspectives podcast. And, they basically just took all those ideas and were like, hey, what if we made a baseball team out of those? Like, that would be funny. And that's cool. Like, that's baseball to me. That's like Bill Veeck style, like, hey, let's treat this like a real sideshow and just do cool stuff. The one where it's like, let's make sure we have exactly the right kind of value metrics so we don't leave any marginal wins on the table is just awful.
And while we're at it, why don't we just hate women? Let's just hate the hell out of them.
Yeah. You know what? Because the problem is our favorite relievers also hate women.
Let's just throw that in there, into the mix. Why not?
Just terrible.
What a franchise. Awful. So they did. They played in the World Series this year, and thankfully they lost.
I mean, especially now.
Yeah, I mean, like, some of this came up during the World Series, which made them losing even more satisfying. But, you know, as we learned post-World Series and every year, it's tough to have heroes when you're an adult, seeing every side of sports, seeing things from more than one angle, seeing them from more than just looking at the sport and being
never
like,
meet or read anything or even like learn the names of your heroes.
Yeah. Just keep as far a distance Trev keeps all of his acquaintances, try to keep at least 10 times that away from the people you don't know, but do, like, you know, respect or are fans of.
You know who my hero is? The guy who runs the bus that I used to take in Chicago. I'll never meet him, and he's my hero.
I was going to say easy that was. Yeah, that's the same. That's a terrific answer. My hero is. I was going to say the guy who runs the train, but that just seems like I feel like
I'm stealing
your idea.
But you know what?
Hey, bus and a train, and you know how about the champion who goes around each night collecting rideshare scooters and brings them to his home and plugs them all into the outdoor outlet, testing strength of the electricity entering his home, making his wife ask why are the lights flickering? It just he wakes up the next morning and he's got a whole fleet of fully charged rideshare scooters to send back out in the city. And as we all know, the type of people who support rideshare scooters are true heroes. And I think we all universally appreciate and love them. So
now, wait a minute.
Yes?
I can't help but agree with everything you're saying.
Hang on a second. I have more to say about how much I love that. Well, folks, yes, the World Series. It happened. The Astros lost. The Washington Nationals won. And one of the ongoing threads of this World Series was the fact that it had been so long since they had played a World Series in Washington, D.C., which they did as part of this World Series.
It was weird. It was a weird gimmick, but, you know, I'm glad they did it, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean, let me ask you, Trev, does it matter to you that there's baseball in Washington? Because I heard the sentiment again and again that, like, it's good for baseball that baseball's back in Washington. Like, this
no,
is crucial.
I don't think it's good.
I don't care.
I think it's fine that the Nationals won. I really have no animus towards the Nationals. I know they're division rivals, and I should, but, like, I mean, honestly, I save my animus for the Braves almost exclusively. I don't really have that much against our other division rivals, even the Mets. Like, they don't really do much for me. You know, when we're playing them, I'd like to win, but, you know, it's not a deep hatred or anything.
Typical Philly fan. That unbridled hatred. When we're playing them, I'd prefer we win. Ugh. Take it down a notch. It's Jeez. Just a game. You're Jeez, disgusting. Wipe that down. Cheese whiz off your mouth and sit down. No, give me more.
No, but I think sports in Washington are, I don't know, the same to me as sports in, like, Phoenix. Like, I don't care. I'm happy that some of my friends like teams that won. That's cool for them. And, you know, a lot of people who, you know, like, I'm sure people who listen to this podcast know people online who like the Nats and like the Capitals and et cetera. And that's cool. Like, I think it's neat that they have a moment. But no, I mean, actually, like, just baseball in Washington as a sort of concept. No, I don't think it's important at all.
Yeah, well, it's the history, I would imagine, that people are citing. And you'd think two people who host a podcast like this would have more of an appreciation of that.
Not really.
I just don't. And maybe it's just because I don't know enough. Maybe that's the problem. But, you know, Washington Senators and blah, blah, blah. I don't care.
I care more about the Cleveland Spiders than the Washington Senators. I'll be completely honest with you.
That's fair. And I think that's fair. Yeah. So, but, you know. Point push comes to shove, they had the World Series in Washington this year anyway. And that's what we're here to talk to you about tonight, folks. Not the World Series this year, but the year in which the last World Series was held. Because we heard about that year quite a bit during this World Series. The year
announcers
right now,
love to talk about history. That's like,
they do.
That's their main thing.
It seems like, well, it's very easy because it's typically very easy to confirm broad facts like when was the last World Series in Washington, D.C.?
Just counts as a frantically checking Wikipedia.
Just covering for time as he scrolls down his phone. And as we all know, the very last World Series of the. Yeah.
Jesus, Joe, come on, load.
Come on, Joe. I thought you were a professional. Yeah. It's it was the fact that everyone latched on to and brought up probably at least once during every broadcast of every game. And it helped that the Nationals had yet to win a playoff series until this year when they won three of them. Postseason series, I guess, three of them.
That's always what ends up happening. You win them in bursts.
Sure.
Sure. Why not?
And so we all learned. We all learned very, very repeatedly that the last time the Nationals had been, or that last time that a Washington-based team, which is the terminology that was used all throughout this process,
Washington.
A Washington-based team.
It's like describing Washington baseball as like a dairy alternative or something. If you or your Washington-based team would like to
enjoy baseball, or if you have a tender stomach, Washington-based baseball.
Talk to your doctor before you try baseball substitute.
So that last, if you were paying attention at all, then you learned during the World Series that the last time a Washington-based team was in the World Series was 1933, which is going to be a lost year in the minds of, I would say, most people watching. Even the one or two generations of fans older than us, Trev, aren't probably going to have been alive at that point. So that's
33 is pushing it. I mean, definitely if they are alive, they don't have a lot of formative memories about that time, right? Because, like, that's when they were probably pretty little.
Yeah, Exactly, and that's very it's a time that exists through a very dense fog of the mists of time. It's lost to many of us, so there's plenty of stories to mine through of that time. Unfortunately, this is kind of where we leave the World Series component of this behind. So when
no.
I say indirectly inspired, this is kind of what I'm talking about, because we're going to travel back to 1933, but we aren't going to be visiting the World Series that year, which the Phillies did obviously not participate in. And this
how
is
how dare you.
This is a Phillies podcast. We forget that sometimes.
Who was in the World Series in 1933, Justin? Can you tell me that?
What a tremendous question. And I'm just going to Joe Buck cover for time here as I scroll and scroll to get the information that we need. And the answer is the New York Giants won the World Series that year against the AL pennant-winning Washington Senators.
So sure, of course.
This episode is actually going to have more to do with the World Series than I realized. I was initially going to apologize because you'd think I would have picked a game in which the Phillies played the AL champion Senators, but they wouldn't have played them because they're in the American
League.
They're
in the AL, yeah, sure, of course.
The Phillies are in the National League. I did, however, manage to find a very filthy, disgusting, forgettable, terrible game that the Phillies played against the New York Giants.
Ah, oh, the 33 Giants, our favorites.
You'll never guess how handedly the 1933 Giants beat the 1933 Phillies.
I imagine quite handily.
It's quite handily. And they kind of did it twice, twice in a row, two different nights.
Defeated it, so nice we had to do it twice.
It was a it was brutal. Honestly, this is one of the more brutal innings I think we're ever going to talk about on this
really?
Podcast. Yeah. I mean, we've handled some pretty some tough to digest innings where it was like, yeah, okay, the other team didn't really beat up on them so much, but the way they scored and like a game winning 2-run rally that no one was expecting with two outs or just, you know, just general things like that. It's just not this one is more notable for its sheer brutality and the fact that it happened twice in two consecutive games. I would say it's unbelievable, but you know, as we learn on this podcast,
nothing
is really
is. Yeah. I like that you managed to not only include 1933, but also one of our all time favorite teams to talk about on this show, the New York Giants.
Yes.
I don't think we've talked about the San Francisco Giants a lot. We've definitely discussed the New York Giants ad nauseum, and I would honestly love a sister podcast if either of us had the time of just New York Giants stories.
I mean, we have enough to do it, I think, already. So
yeah, honestly.
But I want to set the stage here for Philadelphia in 1933. They played a doubleheader against the Giants on August 2nd. Then they just played the Giants again on August 4th. Then on August 5th, they played another doubleheader against the Giants. So it was just five games in a row against the Giants.
What a nightmare.
In what, 4 days? Yeah. So that's brutal on its own.
Why would anyone want that? Like, fans of either team are probably just like, get me out of here.
Yeah. And a great question, because what happened in the middle, the Phillies bookended those five games with wins. They beat the Giants 13-6 in game one of the August 2nd doubleheader, and they beat the Giants 7-3 in game two of the August 5th doubleheader.
Wow.
In between, they managed to get outscored by the Giants 47-5 over the course of the middle three games.
Ooh, wow.
47-5.
40. Okay, you weren't kidding. This is ugly.
Yeah, let's break that down. 47 divided by 3 gives us an average of, if we're rounding up, 16 runs per game in each of the losses. That's
and
not exact.
Did
not
they bunch them like that?
Nay, not quite. It was you turn the dial a little bit to the left. Because when I say two consecutive games were especially brutal, the Phillies lost two consecutive games in 1933. The second game of a doubleheader on August 2nd, and the next game they played, Friday, August 4th. They lost them both by a score of 18-1. Ooh. One of them, yeah, well, it was the August 2nd game, featured a smattering of offense by the New York Giants, in which they scored at least 3 runs in 5 separate innings. You know, bad, tough to watch.
Yeah, not
certainly
great.
Tough
not
to
great.
Experience. Not really a dirty inning in there. You know, not one game, not one frame.
Oh, really?
Where
they just kind of like piled it on the whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just like they maxed out at three, I think, and they didn't really clump all their runs together in any particular inning. The other game featured an inning, Trev, that was much, much dirtier.
I'm very excited to hear about this.
And when we come back from our first break, we'll get into that. Philadelphia, 1933. The city had just approved its lowest annual budget in 10 years for 1934. Ooh, so there were a lot of pants tightening, a lot of beans consuming, a lot of barrel wearing as clothes to look forward to in our city's grim financial future. A riot teetered on the verge of breaking out at the neckwear factory on 6th and Columbia, which is still there to this day. No, it's not. I don't think it is. What is neckwear? Is that jewelry? I kept thinking it was the neck part of a turtleneck.
No. I believe it's a tie. I believe neckwear is considered a tie.
Of course it is. How silly of me. So
you have to admit that is kind of silly of you.
Yes. Oh, I'm openly admitting that. I feel like I just literally said that. Extremely silly of me. But and this was a very serious time at the neckwear factory with, again, violence on the verge of breaking out. 12 women were picketing outside, assaulting workers as they were leaving. There were bricks thrown. One of them tried to stab somebody with a long hat pin. And one local youth, who I guess was just there for fun, showed up and started trying to trip people as they left the factory for the day. So
cool.
A couple of real troublemakers. Like, imagine being like showing up as a scheming youth to cause trouble at the neckwear riot, and a woman's there trying to stab people with a hat pin, and you're like, well, I was just gonna trip some folks as they left work for the day.
Yeah, this middle-aged woman really outdid me.
I don't know what to do. I took the train all the way down here from Upper Darby.
You ragamuffin.
You really ruined this day for me. God, now I gotta go to my night job in a salt mine. Well, there had been a hearing at City Hall about the striking neckwear workers of the city, and people were confident a resolution would be on its way.
You know what happened?
500 workers had walked through the city in a peaceful procession, but then, somebody got a little antsy in North Philly, and suddenly there was a riot about to break out. So, So at 6th and Columbia, things weren't shaping up great. It's just like, it's like the city's got to burn occasionally. It's the ebb and flow of the urban landscape.
If the city doesn't burn, it starts like, I don't know, its antlers get too big or something. I'm just mixing my metaphors now. I don't know.
Yeah. That's who feels silly. It's you.
I really feel extremely silly.
Well, elsewhere, a one-year-old named Rollo, Philadelphia native, one-year-old named Rollo, was rushed to the hospital with a lima bean stuck in his throat. He was coughing and wheezing, but his parents had time to call a doctor, have him say that they need to take Rollo into Philadelphia from where they lived, which was Chester, and then they got the bean out in 5 minutes once they got to the right facility in Philadelphia. So presumably this kid had a lima bean stuck in his throat at the time it took his parents to get from their home to a doctor, who then said, no, you gotta go to another doctor.
Gotta go to a different doctor. I'm not a lima bean specialist.
Oh, you're gonna want the
get
lima
him into
bean
pen
guy.
Quick.
But the kid was fine. Picture of him in the Inquirer with a nurse who had helped with the procedure, and she was smiling, and he had, that sort of lost 1-year-old look on his face, who had just, seen death at an age where he didn't even have, speaking skills yet. So
it's pretty horrible to think about.
Grim stuff.
Yeah.
But he did okay.
I'm glad you brought the atrocity this time. That's good.
Got the lima bean out. We were all set.
Someone eat the lima bean. It was the depression.
Save that bean for later, folks.
That makes one bean soup.
Oh, by the way, I forgot.
Everyone jumping on the floor.
Forgot to tell Nurse Edna she was fired. Send her home with that bean. That'll feed her whole family. Well,
you ever watch that like classic Mickey Mouse?
I know.
It's like Mickey Mouse, like Jack and the Giant, basically. And
I know exactly what you are talking about.
Yeah, he, Goofy, and Donald are cutting a single bean. Yep. They got like paper slid
so
in slices
thin.
Of the bean. It's so good.
Yeah, yeah. I that's crazy. I know exactly what you were talking about.
It's such a good image. Yeah.
Well, elsewhere, Trev, a Philadelphia Boy Scout saved a girl from drowning in Sea Isle. Hero of the day. 10 Philadelphians died from the heat, which was a new record. The temperature, thanks. I mean, not the body count. Clark Gable, speaking of the stars of the era,
they're all here.
He went under the knife for his sudden onset of appendicitis.
Uh-oh.
And an AP story in the Inquirer tells us of this story from the city of St. Louis, which is kind of just insane, and I'll read it to you now. After a spectacular 45-minute machine gun battle by police, George Perry, 43-year-old former hotel clerk, was wounded fatally an hour and a half after he killed Samuel Murtaugh, 77, a wealthy proprietor of several low-price hotels here, with a hacksaw.
Whoa.
Yeah, so the cops just showed up at this hotel where this guy who had murdered an old man with a hacksaw was held up.
How do you murder someone with a hacksaw? Like, you hear about, like, dismembering someone with a hacksaw, but the murder sounds like, it's like a nightmare to murder someone with a saw.
Yep, yep, it's best not to think about it. Yeah, yeah. Blech. So the police sergeant shows up, bangs on the door, tells him to come out. He doesn't come out, fires four shots through the door. And according to the newspaper, according to the Associated Press, holding a mirror outside a window, the police located Perry's position, and Detective Bean, no joke, literally, Detective Bean,
such synchronicity,
ended the battle by sending a volley of 25 machine gun bullets into the
front. I love how delicate the actual process is, where it's like, all right. Get this
Easy.
Mirror lined up right.
Easy.
We only got one shot. Mm-hmm. And then just like, the entire wall falls in. Like, nice work, Detective Bean.
All right, let's pack it in. I hear your wife's got a nice hot lima bean cooking at home.
It's bean soup tonight, boys. I earned it.
Two beans for me. Beans on the house. Also, Trev, an assistant professor of mathematics at the U.S. Naval Academy, told reporters it would cost $100 million to go to the moon. This was 1933, remember? That seems a little early in history for moon talk. Obviously, it wasn't too early, but...
They had to start brainstorming.
It's like in your head, it's like, wow, in 33, they were like thinking about going to the moon, which is crazy. It actually cost $375 million for a Saturn V rocket alone in 1969, the year we actually went to the moon. And the Apollo program in total, just for trivia's sake, from 1960 to 1973, the cost was about $25 billion. But just in general, I mean, how insane would going to the moon sound to people in 1933? Is it like us talking about Mars now? He described tourists floating around, like a shuttle taking tourists up there, letting them float around.
I love when old moon talk happens.
Yeah. And like they let them take pictures, and then they would like that same day get back on the shuttle, come back to Earth, and then as part of the trip, parachute out of the rocket and you know, land back on
classically
Earth.
Like something people love to do on a casual trip.
Yeah, just kind of insane.
Parachute home. Yeah, like, oh well, this will be popular.
Yeah, it's just a bunch of, obviously the chief purpose of going to the moon is to let people take pictures of it.
I like the idea of like it would take $100 billion and then immediately like franchising it, being like, but once we get that initial investment in, we're gonna make lots of money.
Take your pictures on the moon.
I mean, in fairness, if someone was able to do that, that would make a ton of money.
Yeah. And this guy at the U.S. Naval Academy was already thinking of his next big business move. So respect. Always hustling. Yeah. Gig economy. Last local story we'll talk about, setting the stage for Philadelphia in 1933. This is a weird one.
More local news.
A young woman named Louise McKenna disappeared from her family, last seen getting into a car with a motorist at 9:30 on a Saturday night near their home on 13th Street in a spot that is now the heart of Temple University campus.
Can I interrupt and ask a context question?
Yeah.
Isn't just a motorist someone who is driving a car?
Yeah.
So... I mean, that's less than useless.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She was not picked up by a self-driving car.
She was not driven by a motorist, not a ghost.
Important detail.
Some sort of specter.
Yes. The newspaper says she was accepting a lift and puts lift in quotation marks, which is, I don't know what that's, I feel like that's saying something that.
I mean, great. Cool.
Yeah. But this one's weird. Because the husband, when asked about this, is like, yeah, so what happened, I think, is that she had this bout of amnesia. She had another bout of amnesia last May, so that I think that's what's just happening again. And that was him explaining that.
I mean, listen, that's very, very believable.
Stranger still to this, she was at one point... Louise McKenna, was at one point a member of the Bureau of Missing Persons for the NYPD.
Mm. Okay.
My guess here is she knew exactly what she would have to do to disappear. The last bout of amnesia was her trying to get away from her family and leave them behind. She was tracked down, and in doing so, they were like, what are you doing? And she was like, I have amnesia. And they were like, oh, okay, well, you can come back. And she's like, oh, I remember now. And then this was her escaping again. And
I remember, I don't want to come back.
Yeah. And she was like, oh, I'm just going to use my knowledge of how people disappear to disappear. And they'll just assume it was amnesia again. Now I know not to go, you know, to the place they got me last time. That's what I think. Based on my very little information and no knowledge of the real situation whatsoever, also that happened, you know, many decades in the past, that is my conclusion.
Yeah, it sounds plausible.
I think it's deeply sound. Well, in baseball news, in 1933, around this time, early August, a near riot almost broke out in a Pirates-Cardinals game, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer. What had happened was Cardinals pitcher Bill Walker was covering first. Pirates shortstop Archie Vaughn ran into him.
Ooh, isn't Bill Walker one of the Dirty Innings heroes?
You're killing me.
Don't we talk about Walker before?
We have I'm positive we did, but at this point, it's tough. It's tough to keep it straight. There's a lot of legendary heroes in the.
I think there's also someone named Bob Walk, so that's that makes it a little tough.
Yeah, I think we definitely had a guy named Walk who like someone was like, "Oh, he lived up to his name" in the newspaper.
People constantly said that. Yeah.
Well, these two ran into each other, started swinging, but this wasn't even the real fight, though. A run scored during the play that would have tied the game and maintained the. I guess it was the Pirates' 8-game winning streak at the time. So a run scored
seems unlikely.
during that fight. But after the Cardinals protested the run scoring because a fight had been going on, the umpires actually reversed their decision, which you can't do that. It had been a violent series already, and this decision did nothing to stop the screaming. But the Pirates tied the game up anyway later on, and they didn't even need a fist fight to do it this time. Cardinals won the game in the 12th, so everybody stayed mad. But that brings us...
I really love the idea of being like, you know what? You're right.
You talked me into it. What could I say? But that brings us to August in Philadelphia. And as I said, on August 2nd, the Phillies and Giants in 1933 played a doubleheader at the Baker Bowl. The Phillies were beyond buried in the standings at this point, but they did have Chuck Kline, who was the best hitter in the league, hitting a nice round 370 for the season. Phillies took game one by a score of 13-6, like I said, thanks in part to the Giants committing five errors. But
five, count them, five errors.
Game two was an epic disaster. Roy Parmalee was on the mound for the Giants, and he pitched a complete game with 8 hits and 8 strikeouts and just one earned run. Kline went 1-for-4 with a single. He wasn't much help. But the Giants' pitching staff was unhittable at this point, as you could probably have guessed by our lauding of the 1933 New York Giants at the top of the podcast. They
love the Giants.
They sported a screwballer named Carl Hubble, who Kline told reporters... Chuck Klein told reporters he couldn't hit Carl Hubble with a paddle. And Stan Bumgardner of the Inquirer informed everyone that when the leading hitter of the league, in this case Chuck Klein, a man who is clubbing the old horsehide until it winces to the tune of a 370 average, admits that he cannot hit the leading pitcher of the league, even with a paddle, in all capital letters, it is news, in all capital letters.
Just this is just his letter explaining to his editor why he wanted to write about this, and the editor's like, I guess this is the draft, just run it.
Yeah, sure, whatever, just print this.
Fine.
Stan wrote me a letter, take it. The Phillies, on the other hand, sent pitcher Cy Moore to the mound, but he was more like Cy Less. I take your booze. They only make me stronger. He only lasted 3 innings, allowed 9 runs and 11 hits. He was replaced by John Jackson, who pitched the rest of the game, allowing 8 more runs and 13 more hits. They had 1 strikeout on the day between the two of them. The Giants were in first place. And loving it. But in game 2...
One strikeout on the day.
Yes. Between pitchers. The Giants...
That's really hard to stomach.
In game 2 of this doubleheader, they trounced the Phillies 18-1, never scoring, as I said, more than 4 runs in a single inning. And so, frankly, if we're scouring 18-1 losses by the Phillies for hideous innings, I think we can do a little better, and we will. Because fortunately, as I said, the Phillies' very next game was an 18-1 loss too.
Wow.
So, the game recap of this one in the Inquirer opened with a restating of the score, but with an exclamation point. So the first line just said 18-1. And old Stan Bumgardner, he picked up his pen.
My new favorite.
Oh yeah, he's terrific. He says, "How they pounded that apple," he wrote, calling the Giants hit total of the Giants had 23 hits on the day. He called that a skidoo number. Later. Yeah, like 23 skidoo, Charleston.
But 18. Oh. Yeah, 23 hits. Sorry, I heard skidoo and I was like, it's not 18 skidoo.
Come on, it's me, the guy who knows the most about skidoo. And that's not the correct number. Skidoo scholar, Dr. Trevor Strung. How do you think I got the doctor?
They told me my dissertation would be useless, and they were right.
And you're just like in front of a cold, silent panel of academic professionals. You're just doing a Charleston, like a terrible version of the Charleston wave.
What many don't know is that it initially would run out. It was considered popularly known as the 25 skidoo, but noted gangster Al Capone shortened it by 2, and no one was brave enough to correct him. So historians place the 23 skidoo in. That's fine. Just take the doctorate. We don't want to hear anymore.
And you're explaining this. The only sound beyond your talking is like the pathetic squeaking of your shoes as you do Charleston. As you do,
I had to do a Charleston through the whole hour long. Yeah.
Oh, you're sweating. Yeah. It's grotesque. Everyone hates it. Yes. Well, the Giants really pounded the hell out of that apple as Stan Bumgarner took it. And later,
sure, of course.
Later in his description of the events of the game, he reminded fans that the fans had to take it and like it. Basically, he was saying, yeah, look, I watched this game. We all watched this game. My job is to report what happened in this game. So just sit down and shut up and let me write this stupid thing I have to write about this terrible game.
Incredible.
Yes. And so we will break down the details of the game right after we get back from this break. Well, Trev, you're probably wondering, as the Phillies got handed their asses in an 18-1 loss, their second 18-1 loss in 2 games, you're probably wondering, hey, did they even send a pitcher to the mound?
I am wondering that, yes.
Well, that's a stupid question. Of course they did.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about it later. Flint Rem was his name.
And Flint Rem.
He was called a Husky Speedball King. Around the time,
it's also a 1980s cocaine legend.
I was gonna say, yeah. Whose nickname are we gonna say that was? This was around the time of Flint Rem's debut. He earned that name apparently in 1924 from the Hutchinson News. He had apparently had a curveball that served him really well, but he always adjusted his cap at the start of his delivery every time. So no cheating teams could figure out what he did differently each time, no matter what technology they were using, which again at this time was probably like also a trash can, honestly. Yeah,
just like banging on a dang trash can. They're like, quit stealing our signs over there.
It makes perfect sense. His curveball had enough life that he was accused of putting emery on it, a powdered mineral that was supposed to give it a little more movement. This sounds familiar to you. It's probably because the very famous ejection of Phil Niekro.
Yes, of course.
Yes, exactly. And that was decades later. I mean, they were broadcasting games in color by that point. So he was still accused of using emery on the ball for the same purpose.
Was it just that they didn't care very much? Like,
yeah, basically.
I feel like, okay, yeah. Because I was going to say, like, when there's, like, the hint of a bad substance in MLB, like, 800 people take screenshots and then, like, or pictures, rather, and then, like, you know, just, like, zoom in on the hat, and they're like, this looks black, and MLB's like, we've conducted a 40-day investigation into this terrible, terrible crime.
Right.
And in this, it's like, some reporter's like, I think he's using emery. Yep, or he's like, shut up. Trying to watch the game.
Hey, shut up. Yeah, he's like whispering it through the net to him. Hey, I think that guy's got an emery board out there.
Shut up.
Just elbows him in the nose. So of course Flint Rim would deny this, and as a young college hurler, he would get a $10 gold piece for every shutout, and his catcher would get $5 gold piece for that success. He wound up throwing enough shutouts at that point that they had to cut his rate down to a $5 gold piece too, because they just couldn't afford to keep giving him that bonus.
I can't afford to give you so many gold pieces. Please stop pitching so well.
It's the first instance of a player being, you know, deemed less than he was worth by the team he was playing for. It's a little different system back then, but I think
slightly different concept remains the same. You know what? It's similar in its way.
In 1926, it was Rem's third year in the major leagues with the Cardinals at 25 years old. He won 20 games and finished eighth in the MVP voting with 2.2 WAR, three spots above Hal Carlson of the Phillies, who had 8.7 WAR and finished in 11th.
Wow.
So, obviously, they weren't taking that into account back then.
The wins above replacement, not really what they were looking at back in the 70s?
1926.
Excuse me?
That is the year that we are talking about.
I don't know why I said
70s. I don't know why either.
I think for some reason, like, the second pitcher you said, I thought you meant Steve Carlton.
Nope. And Hal Carlson. Totally different guy.
That's why I thought of it, though, because Carlson and Carlton sound similar in my mind. And I was like, oh, Steve Carlton sounds like a guy who had eight WAR pitching. I was like, why are we talking about the 70s? Maybe because of Phil Niekro. This is just a glimpse into the terrors of my mind.
Into the constantly derailing train that is inside of my brain. The only war they cared about back then, Trev, was World War.
Yeah. There wasn't one yet, though. It was kind of between the two.
It was between them, yes. But you know, yeah, they still cared about it, obviously.
Well, yeah, because another one was coming.
Listen, I'll be honest. That's the best line of the episode. So a stronger reaction, I feel like, is
okay.
Is warranted.
3, 2, 1, do it again.
The only war they cared about back then? Well, that'd be World War, Trev. Yeah, that's better. That's very vindicating. I'm pleased.
Whew.
I'm very pleased.
I needed that chuckle.
Hmm. Well, Rem went to the World Series against the Yankees with the rest of the Cardinals, with Rogers Hornsby not looking his way to put him into a game until Game 4. Rem struck out the first two batters he faced, then had to deal with a screaming crowd as Babe Ruth came to the plate. And Hornsby came out to the mound in a bit of managing that I didn't really see an explanation for. He comes out to the mound, and I shit you not, tells him, I want you to throw a high, slow fastball to Babe Ruth.
What?
And
what?
I bet you're wondering what happened next. Well, as Rem told the Greenville News years later, the ball just cleared the right field fence.
there you go. Ruth, if it was just a little slower.
Ruth came up again in the game, and maybe that's what Hornsby said. The problem was you threw it too fast. You got to slow it down even more, because Hornsby said, do the same thing. So he did. This time, the ball went out of Sportsman's Park, across the street, and through the window of an automobile firm and hit a new Chevrolet, according to Flint Rem.
What? Why would he do that?
What?
That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. Like, it's just kind of like if you were playing like a football game, right? Like if you were if it's like, you know, the, I don't know who the Packers are playing next week, but like it's the Packers game and the opposing coach just tells their defensive back, they're like, hey, listen, I want you to leave all of the receivers uncovered. Just don't do anything. Just like kind of watch what Rodgers does. Don't intervene. Just give it a look.
So the ball lands in a car dealership, hits a new Chevrolet. The dealer gives Ruth the car that the ball hits. And Flint runs into Babe Ruth 2 days later. Ruth had hit 3 home runs in that game, by the way. And okay. Flint Rem asked him, you know, did they give you that car? And Ruth said, yeah. And Flint said, well, you ought to give me the spare tire. Such a great,
that's a great line.
20s old man story, just brilliant. Yeah, why are you giving me? And that's how I got this spare tire that's hanging on my wall above the fireplace. That's
amazing.
Babe Ruth's spare tire back when he pummeled me unmercifully due to some bad information from Rogers Hornsby, and that's my baseball legacy. Well, in 1930, I have no idea what's going on in this article. The thing about Flint Rem is that he was a notorious drinker, a problematic drinker, you might say. Something about play.
That's a shame. There were a lot of baseball players who were that way.
Yes. Yeah. And that was, you know, it was basically the drug of choice, I would imagine, at this point in history.
Alcohol?
Yeah.
Yeah. And sweet, sweet heroin.
Mm. Well, that was, I mean, you just buy that at the drugstore. This was.
Yeah. No, that helped with your headaches.
Prohibition era was like hooch was the stuff you couldn't get so easily. So
I guess that's true.
This article, you know,
everyone's just like, no heroin for me. I need something stronger.
Pass me a beer. A beer that's been traveling in the back of a truck for 3 days. Yeah. No, or a beer that's been inside of a false lamp.
We love our beers that are inside false lamps on this show. We love beers that are hidden. We just like whimsy. Please listen to The Dirty Inning.
Secret beers. That's, yes, that is our
secret beers. That's
our
dirty
wheelhouse.
Inning.
The problem here is that, I mean, this article, I think, is about players who were hard partiers and heavy drinkers during Prohibition, with Flint Rem being one of the most notorious of them. I also found him being referred to as a Cardinals playboy in the St. Louis Dispatch in 1930, though maybe that was sarcastic. It's honestly hard to tell. So what we do know is that Rem was an infamous drinker, along with his buddy Grover Cleveland Alexander.
Now we got that's the Senators connection, huh?
And according to his Sabre bio, he once got drunk, passed out in the bullpen, woke up with adhesive tape to his eyes by his teammates, thought he'd gone blind.
Incredible.
Yeah.
That's so good.
And from the article that I was trying to find the point of, it was just tough to break through this 1930s jargon. It was very dense in this article, but it reads in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution as such. Flint Rem was knocked out of the box Thursday, going down for the third time with a gurgling sound, with the bats making music in his ears. Of course, the other pitchers may like their drams too, but Flint Rem serves as a horrible example. It is possible now for the Prohibition folks to wag a knowing noggin and speak of the evils of rum with Flint Rem as their fall guy. Now that Flint Rem has been knocked out, the sports world is without a hard-drinking hero. There are plenty of the boys who take their drams, but they do not advertise the fact through the sports pages or the police columns. So I think they're saying, like, if you're going to drink, be cooler about it, Flint Rem, because everyone knows that you are drunk, but we also know other players are drinking and they're not drunk all the time.
I like that, like, Prohibition, even from the start, everyone was like, oh, this is so stupid.
Why are we doing this? This is the worst time of history. Come on.
It's so funny that, like, because, like, you can imagine that, like, even now, like, we have a major candidate. Well, I don't know how major he is anymore. But, like, I mean, Joe Biden is basically out there saying, like, now, pot's a gateway drug, so be careful. And, like, everyone's like, yeah, maybe it is. And that's like a position you can have. But in this period of time, people are like, watch out for the evils of alcohol. And every person at a newspaper is like, oh, shut up.
Shut up, man.
Just come on.
Well, this
grow
was
up.
This was about 2 weeks after the most notorious of Rem's drinking stories, when he'd failed to show up at the Cardinals clubhouse and then showed up the next day, knocks on the door. The manager, I believe was it Bert Schotten at this point? He answers the door, just cracks, and he's like, yes. I guess if he didn't recognize him.
Hello?
Rem goes to tell this story about how he had been kidnapped by bandits and, well, it gets better, forced to drink liquor at gunpoint. Now, this is going to really surprise you, but he would later admit that this was a complete falsehood. And then a few days later at the Baker Bowl, Rem threw a complete game against the Phillies as a member of the Cardinals, scattering incredible. 7 hits and 3 earned runs in a 9-3 victory that had both.
The bandits just taught him a killer curveball.
No, Flint, you're throwing your curveball all wrong. Your arm action.
First, you
got
to drink
here.
All this liquor, and then I'll teach you.
First, you got to down this hooch. That's the first secret. Feels like this would be the opening for like a musical number in a production. Like, you gotta throw it like this.
Be sure to drink that hooch.
First you take a drink, then you wind it up, then you let loose, and you watch the ball fly
like this.
Yeah,
we should cut this off. This is gonna be big.
So I think this story, to sum it up, proves once and for all that there are zero negative consequences to letting alcohol run your life.
Yeah, that is absolutely the dirty inning promise.
Mm-hmm. So that being said, the good news is that Rem's career took place in the 1930s, and because of that, we have universally renowned sports writer and former Bill Simmons Boston sports and movie blog title, Grantland Rice, to tell us of Rem's exploits. So pitching in Game 3 of the World Series for the Cardinals, Flint Rem was facing the Philadelphia A's, and Rice was kind enough to write some just cunning prose about the events of the game, which ended with the Cardinals losing 6-1, thanks in large part to Rem giving up all 6 runs, 4 of them earned over the course of 3 1/3 innings. The headline on this little section is called Poison to Cards. Grove came through with an off day to battle against, and Earnshaw was poison after the second inning. But there was a sad, wailing banshee note in the winds that blew over the quaint village of Rem, carrying its dirge forward into the cypress swamps just beyond. The coral snake lurked in the silences. Part of this was Rem's fault, and part of it belonged to his support, which was just a bit lumpy in 2 fatal innings.
It's amazing.
I wish people could write about baseball like this. At all anymore.
Yeah,
you know?
No one can, because no one thinks about it like it's some sort of poem anymore. Like, not even us, obviously. Like, I just think that's lost.
I would say this podcast is my desperate attempt to cling to things like this. Because
I mean, we're close. I would say we do our best with it, but like at the same point, we also are just like, yeah, that guy had a like this war, and here's what he did. Like on this, like we still have that knowledge, and like Grantland Rice was like. The bag man sat on third, weighing his options as the drowned man and Gilead might at the same time. It's like, to him, that's the only way you can think about baseball.
Yeah, I think the best baseball writers are like the poets and storytellers who just found themselves accidentally in a press box. While like the guys who were like, I'm going to be a baseball writer, are the ones who wind up getting burned out and
yeah, exactly.
displeased by it. So what we talk about at the top of the show, that it like... the idea of baseball as this like nostalgic, majestic thing has been poked through by more than just what's going on in the sport now. But when we're living in a time of history where we're talking about making deep cuts of the concept of minor league baseball, we're talking about a team, you know, having its recent success questioned and creating questions about other teams' success all across the sport because of a complex series of functional cheating. The ball constantly. What's changing with that? Why won't we? Why doesn't anyone talk about? Why can't we get a straight answer about what's going on with the baseball? I mean, it's just it's created way too many questions. And you know, I always talk about the X factors in baseball. It feels like that's all it's made up of anymore, and they're all coming from outside the game, not inside. So it's you know, it's probably tougher to write a poem about something like that. It's not like shady things weren't happening at this point in history when Grantland Rice was writing about baseball, but like
writers weren't expected to care about it as much, I don't think.
Yeah, neither were fans. So
yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. Well, in any case, Rem was the man on the mound as the Phillies looked to rebound from an 18-1 beatdown in Game 2 of that doubleheader on August 2nd, 1933. Oh, before we get into that, one last thing. I found an article from 1936 for a team Rem was playing for at the time that was referred to as the,
fantastic,
the Richburgers, because the manager's last name was Richburg. And now this is something that I've seen this before in these old newspapers. This is a time period when this was common practice, using the manager's name to give the team a nickname. So let's go back and do that to a few more modern Phillies teams, like the Sandburgers, the McCainanites, the Kaplerites, the Manuelians, the Girarders, and of course the Moxketeers.
Oh my God.
This is a real thing.
Why did you say the World War line was why did you think that was the best joke? The Moxketeers is way better. I also like the McCainanites. That's really good. I like this trend. We should bring it back.
Yeah, I mean let's remember this because this was definitely a trend. Well, like I said, in any case, Rem was on the mound. Phillies didn't want to lose 18-1 again to the Giants, but guess what? They were going to, as Stan Bumgarner wrote, 18-1! Exclamation point. He says,
lest we forget.
It is not the new silver coinage ratio, he says, or the score of the Notre Dame-USC football game. It is the score of the Phillies losing to the
Giants.
Why
would that be the score of a football game?
That's a really good point.
Is anyone thinking?
It's an excellent point.
That classic score where a football team earns 1 point.
Oh, let's just kick the extra point instead of a field goal and not a touchdown.
I renounce this touchdown, but can I have the extra point?
The Giants were up 7-1 by the eighth inning, but that wasn't enough to make them feel okay on August 4th, 1933, playing in the Baker Bowl, an infamous hitter's park, especially down the right field side. Dimensions that have been said to have been a big reason for the lefty Chuck Klein's inflated numbers there. So Bill Terry, the Giants manager, did not want to let up, even with a 6-run lead and 2 innings left to play. He felt that that park offered too many opportunities for an offense to catch up, even with a deficit of that size. So
that's a great strategy from a period of time where I feel like that kind of strategy was seen as like kind of bad to have, like, mm-hmm. Oh, be a good sport. Don't lay it on. And like, it's such a good baseball strategy to be like, no, we have to be up 12 runs or else it's like, it could go very wrong.
Have you played in this park? Like, good Lord, we got to score as much as we can. Cause Chuck Klein's going to hit 4 home runs next inning. So Waddy Clark started the day pitching for the Giants. And in the bottom of the seventh, the Phillies actually hit back-to-back singles off of him. And just as they seemed to be figuring him out, Bill Terry, who was so wary of giving up his sizable lead, yanked his starter and put in Carl Hubbell.
Oh, no.
That's like putting Garrett Cole in to pitch in the World Series in relief, only a regular season game, up by 6 runs to a team in like 5th place in the division.
That's so good. I love it. I'm extremely excited about this.
So Bumgarner, you know, in the newspaper agrees with me. That act was the equivalent of pulling the asbestos curtain down on the Schotten fire. Schotten was the name of the Phillies manager at the time. It smothered it entirely. Hubbell's entrance into the fray was the signal for all the women fans, and there were about 5,000 present, to sigh in such a way as to make the stand shudder. Don't tell me the fair sex ignores the sports pages and does not know it's baseball. So I think he was... I think he was big with the ladies. I think Carl Hubbell was. Yeah,
not you're not talking about Bumgarner.
No, I think
Bumgarner seems like he's kind of being condescending.
No, he's talking about Carl Hubbell coming out and being like, causing the ladies in the house to swoon. So I think he had a reputation for something of a handsome gentleman about town. But him entering the game erased any chance of the Phillies scoring 5 more times.
And I really love the idea of like just completely, again, like, this is just smart managing. Like, I love the idea of just completely demoralizing your opponent by being like, oh, yeah, I see that you're like hoping for a rally here, but actually I'm putting in my ace. It's like being up 9 runs and being like, okay, so my relief ace is going to come in now. Is that cool? Like, we're gonna wrap this one up.
Yeah, I mean, why not? You know, like, this is
exactly right.
This is we want to win this game. The goal is to win this game, so let's win it. And you know, like I said, erased any chance of the Phillies scoring a few more times. And in the top of the 8th, our dirty inning, the Giants made sure that there would be no joy in Mudville. I just want to say, Flint Rem pitched this entire inning. He took every lick. And you reach a point as a pitcher when, even when you're absolutely blowing it, somehow you become lauded for your ability to get beaten up. Like,
oh yeah.
The writers switch from like, oh, he blew it, to like, you know what? He took his licks, as if that's like a skill of some kind.
I mean, it kind of is. Like, you have to, I think on some level, you have to be able to like come back from that.
That's true.
Like, that feels like something that if you were kind of like a lesser pitcher in some way, that you would just end up being like, well, I can't ever pitch again. Like,
right.
All I see whenever I see a baseball now is that inning that just happened.
And what an inning it was. So
great.
Blondie,
I can't wait.
Blondie Ryan is the first guy up Flint Rem faces. Now remember, the Giants are ahead 7-1 in the top of the 8th, and Flint Rem's facing the bottom two guys in the order to lead off. Gives up a leadoff single to Blondie Ryan. Next guy up is Carl Hubble, the pitcher. And boy, you think, boy, this is a great time to get a double play.
Would be a great time to get a double play. You are absolutely correct.
Maybe even just like a if he wants to sack bunt, you know, at least you get an out of it. Hell no. Flint throws, cannot get the ball over the plate, walks the pitcher, putting runners on first and second. JoJo Moore.
Like, walking the pitcher might be one of the worst things you can do.
Yeah, opposite of good, absolutely. JoJo Moore comes up, smacks a triple that knocks in both runners, makes it 9-1. He's followed by Bernie James, who actually Flint Rem manages to, he's a big ground ball guy that year, got him to ground out to second base. Thankfully, only 2 runs in. Again, the Phillies don't have any chance of winning this game anyway. He's already given up 2 runs. And then the manager comes up.
He hits a home run.
You forget. Yeah. Phil Terry's not just the manager. He's also playing in the game. And
I love player managers. It's so good.
He comes up with a runner on third, knocks him in with a single.
Bill Terry had himself playing leadoff, or was he pitching? Was he batting after the pitcher?
No, he was batting third in this case.
Okay. I lost. These innings are so hard to keep track of.
Yes,
sometimes.
They are. They are very hard. Yeah. He's followed by Mel Ott, who Rem then
yes,
walks.
A classic of the genre.
Yeah, works a walk. Flint Rem then hits Lefty O'Doul with a pitch that puts runners on every base.
Great.
Johnny Verges comes up. Fortunately, managed to get a ground out from him with a force out at home. But that's just 2 outs and the bases are still loaded. So Paul Richards comes up. He hits a single that knocks in 2 runs. Blondie Ryan comes back up. He hits a single to reload the bases. Carl Hubble, the pitcher, again, comes up. And with an utter death blow for everyone's emotions at this moment, triples to center field. Scores every run. And they're not even done. JoJo Moore comes back up. He doubles in Carl Hubble from third base.
Is there anything worse than a pitcher triple?
Hitting a bases loaded triple?
I mean, there can't be. I mean, hitting a bases loaded triple is one of the worst things that can happen. But like, a pitcher hitting a bases loaded triple is even worse, I think, than a pitcher hitting a grand slam.
Yeah.
Because, like, at a certain point, you at least have the idea that, like, oh, well, I just threw a bad one. At that point, you have thrown such a bad pitch that your defense couldn't handle where it landed. Like, everything has failed.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And, like, the rally continues, and, yeah, it's just a – it's brutal. Wow. Like I said, it's a brutal, brutal inning.
It's amazing.
And, you know, obviously it's getting a Rem too, because he uncorks a wild pitch to Bernie James, who comes up next. But fortunately,
naturally, yes.
And fortunately gets him to ground back out to the pitcher, and the inning comes to a merciful close. It's 16-1 at this point. The Phillies go down 1-2-3 against Hubble. Fortunately, wow. Flint wasn't the one coming back out. He was pulled after that point.
I mean, at that point, just pull him for his health.
Yeah. Phillies obviously did no more scoring on that day. They had scored their only run on Waddy Clark with a Chuck Fulis double. Back in the bottom of the fifth. And that was it. That was all they were going to score on the day. And the Phillies were utterly decimated, outscored 18-1 on August 4th, 1933 in front of 5,000 people.
Man.
Out-hit 23-10. They committed two errors. The Giants committed no errors. Everybody's pissed. Bumgarner writes that Bert Schotten, the Phillies manager, sent out the next Phillies pitcher, Ad Liska, with a steel helmet.
Oh, wow. That's so good.
Oh,
I love it.
And that is the utter mess the Phillies found themselves in August 4th, 1933.
God, that is so bad.
Real bad.
I can't believe, I mean, you told us at the beginning, you intuited, that's the word I'm looking for, that this would be like a bad one. You have warned us how bad this would be.
It got real bad.
It got so bad.
How do you even want to look at a baseball after two games like that? One of which featuring an inning like this. If you're the specific pitcher that inning happened to, but also if you're anybody standing there watching, like how tired are you? Like, there's got to be one of the like right fielders probably didn't get the ball in that inning, and he just had to stand there and watch nine runs come in over the course of a single inning.
How do you do it as the manager?
Yeah.
Like, how do you open up as the manager and be like, all right, so we're going to come back here tomorrow and we're going to practice. And probably there's a game tomorrow too. So everyone be sure to play, like be really excited and ready to play this baseball game that's coming up. Like, how do you rally the troops around that?
We're just going to come out here and we're going to play baseball and we're going to shut up and we're going to play. Stop crying. We're going to play, but stop crying. We're going to play baseball and it's going to be great. We're going to have a happy damn time on the, stop crying. Yeah. I can't imagine. So that is
just
the
awful. Yeah.
Brutality of baseball in Philadelphia in 1933. I mean, this was not a good Phillies team by any stretch of the imagination. They finished 60-92, seventh place in the National League. Yeah, they're playing in the Baker Bowl, which was, I think, no one's favorite park, except if you were, you know, Chuck Klein.
Yeah. And it was good to please Chuck Klein at that point in time.
Sure. But yeah, that is the that is our reference to the last time the Washington-based team played in the World Series, which they did again this year. And now we face a long off season following the World Series, full of many more Phillies moments that we'll get to turn into dirty innings. So as the off season stretches on, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and download all your favorite Phillies podcasts, including Hittin' Season with John Stolness, Continued Success with myself and Liz Rocher, and of course this podcast, The Dirty Inning with myself and Dr. Trevor Strunk.
Yay! Always a pleasure, Justin.
Yes, we have a lot of fun.
Love to be here.
We have a lot of fun doing this podcast, and we'll be having a lot more fun bringing it to you all winter long. So keep listening, and we will talk to you next time on The Dirty Inning.
Bye-bye.